Welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure, brought to you by the Global Infrastructure Investor Association. Now more than ever, governments around the world are recognizing the importance of partnership with the private sector to deliver the transformational investment required to meet global challenges. But how do we deliver the enormous scale of investment needed to close the infrastructure gap in an affordable way, whilst addressing societal challenges such as net zero commitments, climate resilience, and the digital economy? GIIA and its members are at the forefront of this debate, and Talking Global Infrastructure is the podcast that will delve into these subjects and more to bring you valuable insights from the experts in the sector.
Hello, I'm Lawrence Slade, Chief Executive of the Global Infrastructure Investor Association, and you're listening to the fifth instalment of our podcast series, Talking Global Infrastructure. Today, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Shadow Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds to discuss Labour's infrastructure vision. Now, Jonathan is well versed in all matters of investment and infrastructure, having been elected to the UK House of Commons for the Labour Party more than a decade ago. Jonathan has held posts right the way across the business brief, from energy, climate, treasury, and indeed rail briefs. So very well judged to cover our topics and our listeners' core interests. So welcome to the podcast, Jonathan, and it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. It's lovely to be on and be able to reach the audience that you've got here. And we've always worked closely together, and I always appreciate that. So thank you for the chance to be able to come on and answer some questions today.
No, it's great in these days of political turmoil to have these slightly longer lasting relationships, isn't it? So let's try and get into this and dig a little bit deeper into where the Labour Party are sitting these days. So if I kick off with some of the findings from our latest member poll survey, which we do twice a year, it shows that the UK has gone from being the most appealing to the least appealing investment destination in Western Europe in terms of infrastructure investment, simply from the spring through to autumn of this year. And of course, our regulatory framework has generally been known as a gold standard. But yeah, we've also seen sort of some of that dipping down and some of the problems there, and now seen as considerable barriers to investment compared to other parts of Europe and indeed the USA and Canada. I'm kind of intrigued from a Labour government point of view. Yeah, how would you go around improving investor confidence in the UK, and in particular, sort of the role for private investment in infrastructure?
Well, yes, Lawrence, I think first of all, the thing to say is that the findings you have there are fair. There are things that people say to me frequently, and fundamentally, I suppose how I often express it is, I'm able as Shadow Business Secretary to go along to, you know, really almost any workplace, any business, any factory in this country. I see some absolutely amazing things, and I really mean that. I see things that excite me, that I think are massive commercial opportunities for the future, massive, you know, sovereign capabilities, whether that's around green hydrogen or traditional manufacturing processes, or obviously clean energy across the piece is an exciting opportunity. It could be in the City of London, it could be in my own constituency. We have some incredibly innovative people in this country and huge opportunities ahead of us. And yet, as you have said, I mean, you can't deny the fact that the UK has the lowest level of business investment in the G7. I find it quite hard and actually quite a lot frustrating to compare those two things. You know, how do you go and have these marvelous experiences where you visit places and then take a step back and look at the aggregate performance of the UK economy as a whole? And I don't just mean in the last few weeks. I mean, you know, over the last 12 years, we clearly haven't seen the kind of productivity growth we would all want. We haven't seen the overall level of economic growth we would like. And many, I think, of the tensions in the UK right now, you know, come back to that. Everything that we are trying to put forward with our alternative plan to growth from the government is first of all about addressing that investment need. So what are the institutions as well as the policies that will require and provide for this country having that much improved performance on business investment? So that is for us things like a long-term industrial strategy, but not just replicating what we saw briefly under the Theresa May government. What are the institutions we can put in place so that people know that strategy will be adhered to and will be part of government policy, between business secretaries, who do tend to change, unfortunately, quite a bit, and between other changes in government? I think it's also about devolution, and Gordon Brown is doing a really important piece of work for us we're going to publish soon about economic centralisation, particularly in England, and how can certain things, particularly around labour market interventions and employment programmes, how could they be done better at a more local city region level? It's about knocking down specific barriers to investment. So business rates is a massive issue. I think there's a genuine set of complaints from business around the disincentives they provide and the overall burden that that now represents in the tax system. Improving our relationship with the single market as part of our plans. We don't think you can refight the Brexit arguments. We don't think there's anything to be gained from that, but we do think there are things like an SPS, a veterinary agreement with the single market that we can pursue, mutual recognition of professional qualifications, touring rights for creative industries. I mean, things that were on the table, being part of the Horizon Science program across Europe, all things that would make tangible, you know, benefits, but also are deliverable and actually would go a long way to resolving both the relationship and the situation in Northern Ireland, but also our long-term economic performance. You know, fundamentally, we want to put in place, Lawrence, a framework that takes the incredible things that are going on in the UK and provides for that much greater degree of confidence that will attract the investment required. And I think that's what we've needed on any level for the last decade. I think if you look at the challenges, particularly around net zero, huge investable questions. State clearly can't do it all on its own. It's got to be done in partnership with the private sector. Got to be opportunities. A specific thing that I'll mention as well for your listener audience is Lord Jim O'Neill is doing some work for the Labour Party on startups and scale-ups. We intend to publish that report on the 8th of December, so fairly soon. But particularly around the scale-up part of that, we've been looking at sources of capital, both cultural and regulatory barriers to freeing up more of that to invest in the UK. And I think if you add all that up, I mean, I think the serious position to take in British politics around the economy now is not a kind of, here's my magic wand, where that's in the past been presented as Brexit or austerity or the super deduction, but what are the 8-9 tangible, serious, substantial improvements that will increase the overall level of competitiveness of the British economy across the piece? And I'd say, I mean, around the political instability, look, political instability always leads to economic instability. You can't separate out the two things. I do think fundamentally you need a government where at the very minimum, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the Business Secretary are all on the same page on this agenda. And I can say, look, the whole shadow cabinet is behind me when I talk about these things. And I think until there's a chance to get rid of the political instability in the UK, and I think a general election is the only way to do that, we don't yet have a chance to get the things we really need to do and see.
So I think those are really good positive sentiment, Jonathan, there, and particularly, as you say, in terms of our audience of private investors. Just to try and unpack that a little bit more, in your recent conference speech, you highlighted Labour's plans, and indeed you mentioned it from the May government as well, for an industrial strategy. And these have always had a kind of mixed reception, if you like. Now, that strategy refers to various missions through which take an active role in catalysing investment, breaking down barriers and acting in partnership. Now, it's probably fair to say that over the past or the latter part of the last decade, that wasn't really a Labour piece, shall we say. So perhaps you could unpack what those missions actually mean and sort of, I know it's a little bit early for this, but sort of how might you address that in terms of a Labour manifesto?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing to say is whether I go to a trade union conference or a business association, they ask for this country to have an industrial strategy. And they ask for that because we are missing out on opportunities that are going to other countries. I mean, a recent example given to me, a very large pharmaceutical company just invested €1 billion in France. And I said, you know, well, why not the UK, Europe? You've got a footprint here. Life sciences is clearly a significant UK strength. And they said, well, look, the choose France policy from President Macron is just more attractive right now. And whether you like the language of industrial strategies, I mean, I think most countries are quite comfortable with this. We seem to often juxtapose ours to the 1970s, which was, generally pretty dreadful policy for economic decision-making across many different aspects in the UK. But, you know, to me, it is simply the question of how are you arranging your policies, your institutions to maximise the opportunities available to your country based on the strengths that you have here and the opportunities as you see them. It's not about, you know, the 70s, not about industrial reorganisation from Whitehall or picking winners or anything like that. But it is the fact that many people, many senior business people say to me, they just don't understand what this country's pitches anymore. They don't understand what is our post-Brexit belief in how we will, you know, go forward and do what we need to do. And I think that is a fair point to make. So the industrial strategy is an attempt to respond to that, but also to recognise explicitly the political instability that has been the cause of a great deal of economic instability and try and address that on an institutional basis, which I think it's important to have the humility to recognise that is necessary now in the UK. It's emissions-based industrial strategy, and people who are familiar with this will know that missions are economy-wide, sector-wide challenges that you are putting forward, and you're not therefore picking any particular sector or business as being the answer to those, but understanding where you see opportunities for the future. So we put forward four, which were clean energy, the care sector, data, and national resilience, partly a response to that last one to some of the geopolitical instability we've seen and are projecting forward in the future. But to be really explicit about why some of the language that you've mentioned there is part of what we're saying is, look, I'm explicitly drawing a contrast to I think the last few Labour manifestos, which I think got it wrong. I think, you know, there's too much of a belief that the state could do everything. I just don't think that's possible. Also, actually, maybe in a way, making a contrast to the last Labour government as well in some of the last few years and saying there are things, particularly around clean energy, that require government not to, to pick winners, but to recognise there are decisions that will then trigger major investment one way or the other. But the government needs to steer a little bit on that. I think you particularly see that around green hydrogen in particular and the kind of barriers we've seen, you know, the onshore wind ban and things like that in the last few years in the Conservative government, where if you're saying clean energy for decarbonisation and energy security and reliable pricing is a priority for this country, you've got to then have that reflected in, for instance, you wouldn't ban onshore wind, would you? You wouldn't risk those investments by saying you're going to go for a short-term dash for gas or bring back fracking. You know, it's that fundamental lack of consistency that we're seeking to address. And just specifically on one point where you talked about catalytic investment, I mean, I think there are lots of things that need to happen for this country to hit net zero. Some of it is behaviour change, I accept that. But fundamentally, I see it as a question of investability. I see it as a question of, are there investable propositions out there, either through the regulatory environment that we put forward as a country, or the level of public investment that's sufficient to leverage in the vast amounts of private investment that are required? And I think the answer on both of those questions at the minute, unfortunately, is no for the UK. Those things aren't right, despite the brilliant innovation that we've got. If you look, for instance, at the UK government's buildings strategy for net zero, you know, I think it's based on broadly an assumption that 94% of the funding for that will come from the private sector. Now, that is not realistic. You and I know, we've worked in the past in these areas, that there are some things where absolutely the market is there. There are other things around older properties, solid wall properties in the UK, where you're not saying the government should spend the money to fix those, but you must spend enough money to make a market. You know, and I would say, where we've seen successes in the UK, offshore wind is a really good example of one. That is one of the too few examples we've got of the government committing resources, but working in partnership with the private sector to do it, saying, you know, these are the things that will de-risk the investments we're asking you to make. But if you do that, you will then compete to get the best value around that. As a result, we've got offshore wind at a price that I personally would not have believed possible 5 or 6 years ago. I wouldn't have thought we'd see the progress. So it's not about crowding out private investment. It's about what is required to bring in the kind of money that is, I think, essential to meeting net zero and our other wider policy objectives. And that's fundamentally why it mentions partnership so much.
So I think those are a really fair answers, Jonathan, and I really appreciate some of the comments there in terms of the use of private investment and the difference between recognizing nascent technologies or areas where private markets can't work, so to speak. But in terms of confidence of the market, you'll be very familiar, and indeed Labour have been asking for various windfall taxes and so on. And I think if I'm looking at the UK at the moment as an investor, and for that, you know, to be fair, other markets as well, I'm seeing sort of areas where we're looking at labyrinths, if you like, of levies and incentives and windfall taxes here or revenue caps there, etc. And I wonder from a Labour perspective, I know things change, but as things stand today, sort of what's your thoughts now? We've got COP27 going on over in Egypt, obviously, right now. And we know we've got to leverage more investment, as you rightly say, towards hitting net zero. But we've also got to make the country more appealing. So sort of how do you square that circle as an incoming Labour government, potentially? Yeah, how do you square this circle around getting the investment, but also sort of raising the tax you need to sort of run the economy, if you will?
Look, I do accept at the minute there's a lot of political and economic uncertainty that goes beyond just who's going to be in which cabinet jobs by the end of the week. And the first thing I'd say is on things like windfall taxes, I do think there's a fundamental different argument where you've had something like the grotesque Russian aggression and invasion of Ukraine that has had a corresponding impact on the gas market, and that has then produced this extraordinary situation in terms of the volatility of gas prices and therefore of the profits that have come to electricity generators whose price is obviously pegged, benchmarked against that. I think recognizing that as an area that needs a specific intervention from government is different to, for instance, just broadly advocating windfall taxes in such a way that does undermine uncertainty. I mean, I really do think that business themselves recognises that this is a particular situation coming from the war in Ukraine, and that, you know, frankly, unless interventions have taken place, as they have done in the UK around particularly domestic and business energy bills, the actual overall, you know, impact on the British economy could have been catastrophic. And I know that's not going to always be popular, but I do think it's a recognisable case. I mean, on the wider picture of, first of all, we do need to make the UK more attractive as an investment destination to hit our investment goals. There's no doubt about that. I do think that's about stability. I think it's also about things like skills and labour and skill shortages are raised with almost every business I meet with me. There are some major infrastructure challenges in the UK that relate to that too. I am always struck by the fact that when I'm talking to a round table of businesses, we'll start talking about what people would broadly describe as business policy. So, you know, incentives, regulation, the fiscal position. It very soon becomes a conversation about things like, you know, transport infrastructure and even childcare. That overall, that the UK's kind of its menu of policies, if you like, are not right at the minute. And what I really fear, we're recording this just before, you know, the autumn statement is due. First of all, I really resent the way as we get towards budgets now in the UK. It seems every different day there's some speculation, almost expectation management, which is, you know, almost certainly not going to happen. I would be frankly amazed if, you know, capital gains taxes applied to domestic residences has been raised this week. And I think that undermines, you know, the idea that there's a stable position in the UK quite considerably. But my broader worry is we might see cuts to the kind of things which I think are essential for long-term prosperity in the UK. So I really do think the lack of economic integration across the north of England where I live is a massive problem. It is very hard to tell businesses they could be, you know, based, say, in Stalybridge and Tameside in my area and have access to a labour market that runs from Liverpool, Hull to Newcastle and Sunderland, because it's not how it is. I'm also really worried to hear, you know, there might be stories around, I think, you know, there's been a suggestion that new nuclear won't go ahead over the weekend at the same time as the government's not keen on solar in fields and isn't keen on onshore wind. And these are not helpful positions, I think, to put out there. So I hope the long-term position in terms of what we see in the Autumn Statement isn't risking those investments, which I think are essential. I think there is a difference in what might have to be done on revenue spending compared to investment spending.
So just to bring you back there, Johnny, a moment, if I may. So I was chatting to one of our investor members this morning who were really concerned about windfall taxes and the structure of them. It would just, I think, be useful given the audience to sort of, how would you see this going forward? I mean, would it be a case of balancing windfall taxes on excess profits against or with sufficient tax incentives to encourage and bring forward new investments? Do you see that balance or how would you see that in action?
The positions that we put forward on the windfall tax specifically were, I know the government calls it an energy profits levy, but it's basically, you know, they took that from us. We would have started it from the beginning of the year. It would apply to electricity generators as well. We wouldn't keep the incentives for fossil fuel investments that Rishi Sunak introduced. We just don't see the logic at all of doing that, to be frank. As I said, this is a specific issue around what has happened relating to the invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent impact on gas prices. And I don't expect it to be popular, but I do think people get this is, you know, to what we might call, you know, calling for something like this in peacetime, which frankly we wouldn't be in the business of at all. It's specifically around this intervention. The last thing I was just going to say is that on this point of, there's a lot of talk at the minute about fiscal black holes and so forth, 1% growth, which is, you know, broadly what we've seen for over a decade now and is what the projections now show again in future, is not going to pay for the kind of public services and living standards, I'll be frank, that, you know, my constituents expect and most British people do. And I do think the conversation has to be about growth. I mean, I'll say it sounds counterintuitive, I know, but I think Liz Truss was right to put that forward. I think Kwasi Kwarteng Fraser, vicious cycle of stagnation. I mean, maybe not politically wise for him to say that, but I think he's right on that. Having done the work and pensions job in the shadow cabinet, I'm often amazed that this relatively little commentary on the fact that, you know, in real terms, our DWP spend, based on the biggest part being retirement spend, goes up £6 billion a year in real terms every year. I mean, when you think over a 4 or 5 year parliament, that is a substantial increase.
It is, yeah.
We shouldn't talk about that in a negative way. It's absolutely fantastic that people are living longer, and, you know, that should be celebrated and the impact that has on society, culture, families, you know, grandparental, childcare is a major positive. And what I think the people who were sat in my chair when they created the NHS and so forth would have always hoped for. But we've got to recognise that. I would say that, frankly, what you see now, you know, industrial action from barristers to call centre workers to nurses, all comes from the last 12 years of poor economic performance because people feel there's been pain and they want to object to that. But I think the conversation is far better being about innovation, reforming business rights, long-term investment, sorting out our relationship and making Brexit work with the European Union than, you know, for instance, as we saw from Liz Truss, borrowing money to pay for tax cuts. That's sensible. But I think the right bit is the conversation should be about growth as well as, you know, the taxes that are required to fill the damage that's been caused by 12 years of poor growth and then the mini budget.
Yeah, no, I mean, all valid points. And of course, throw into that mix, of course, we're coming out of two and a half years of COVID and still the after effects are there. And as you say, with Brexit as well. So it's been a challenging few years to say the least.
Yeah, the crucial long-term thing there I'd look at is the level of, you know, economically inactive British people. I mean, a huge 5 million now. It's a huge number. You know, some of that, I think, is down to delays in NHS care, which comes partly from the pandemic. But, you know, when I talk about devolution, I mean, that's a real issue, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge, yeah. And I think that's another challenge we've got, Jonathan. But just moving on the conversation a little bit, because I wanted to touch on some of the things we're seeing over in the USA at the moment, and not so much on the midterm elections, because we don't know the results of those when we're recording this, but more on the fact that politics everywhere seems to be seen as pretty divisive. Actually, I mean, there's always been a little bit of tension in that. But over in the US, we've seen the Bipartisan Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act and more latterly, the Inflation Reduction Act. And they're spurring huge levels of interest and are creating a tailwind for private investment. Do you see an opportunity in the next year, the next decade, to get that kind of cross-party action and agreement to how we deal with some of the big issues that we've touched on already in terms of infra investment or social investment, et cetera? You know, is that will there still in UK politics, or have we got to go for a reboot, if you like?
Well, I hope so. And I think it is there. I mean, I think the paradox of the US is everywhere you go, people talk about the Inflation Reduction Act and the impact that's had on investment decisions and the discount for, you know, the attractiveness that's made the US as a destination. And we're very interested in that. That's happened alongside, frankly, a general deterioration in US political culture that genuinely worries me. I mean, you know, there are, whatever the outcome of the midterms, the number of people who are running who don't accept the outcome of the last presidential election is a worry to me because, yeah, clearly, I would say one of the things that failed states always have in common is people don't accept the democratic process, and you don't expect to see that in a country as significant as America. And I think also, you know, can't deny the fact that the wider impact of that is, I mean, Europe is, let's be honest, still dependent on the US for its defence. I mean, there's no question about that. So you can't ignore what's going on in the US, and yet they have produced at times some incredible pieces of legislation by working together. I sincerely hope that UK politics doesn't go down the general direction that I see in the US. And I have at times thought that was going to be the case. You know, I felt a sort of, you know, self-identifying moderate voice like myself might be in the wrong profession at one time when it was getting more and more extreme. Sometimes I thought on either side, but I don't think necessarily that is the destination we get to, though I do see some parts of the Conservative Party that are not in some ways dissimilar to that kind of direction that the Republicans have gone in the US. But I do think it's possible. I mean, I really celebrate, for instance, that we have still, there's no serious political party in the UK that denies the science of climate change. You know, I think actually when you boil down to our analysis of where the economy's gone wrong, that low investment, low productivity, how can we fix that? I don't think many Conservative colleagues would disagree with that. I think many of them feel quite embarrassed that, you know, you've had these different phases of conservatism under different prime ministers. But last time we had business questions, Jacob Rees-Mogg was the business secretary. And when I put to him, you know, why has the UK got the lowest level of business investment in the G7? He's not really got an answer to that because he knows that's a problem, you know. So I think we can put things in place. And I think, to be frank, explicitly, I know industrial strategy is a term that's more comfortable in the Labour Party than the Conservative Party about. But my argument is, well, look, if business associations and businesses themselves are asking for this, it doesn't matter what you call it, but what they're asking for is consistent long-term policies that take some interest in how internationally competitive the UK is. I think they can accept that. And I think actually how we would have the Industrial Strategy Council functioning, which would be like the Committee on Climate Change. So it's an expert, peer-led organization with real standing in public life who can say, well, if you want to be a science superpower, this is really where we're at. No hiding place on that. Or, you know, this is, if we want to keep our automotive sector in the UK, this is where we are relative to, you know, Germany, Slovakia on battery production and what that might be. I think that would help with that. I want British politics to be, Lawrence, about serious, long-term, you know, policies that will benefit the UK. And ideally, you'd forge a consensus around those things, but I suppose that does partly come down to who's in the House of Commons and who wants to be involved in politics. And I know it's not always attractive at times, but I think that's possible if you put it in those terms. And I think, I mean, I have, for instance, been, and you will be aware of them very much, but, you know, you think about times when governments have announced major initiatives, so, you know, home insulation, to give the example, and a policy has not lasted 12 months. I mean, that's no good. That's no good for anybody and everyone. I can't see the argument against that. So I think the long-term framework we can put in place around devolution, institutions, as well as fiscal incentives and all the stuff you usually get from budgets, I think it can be done. I don't think there are many people who really disagree with, if you really boil it down, what we need to do, which is sort out our skills system, sort out devolution in England, sort out long-term industrial strategy. They might use different terms, but I think they would agree on that. Partly, I think, to be frank, when people engage in these largely futile sort of culture wars around kind of non-economic issues, I think partly that's to distract from poor economic performance. You know, I don't think those are the major issues facing the country. You know, what the National Trust is doing is the long-term environment. You know, and I think we can focus on that, but, you know, you've got to do it and bring people with you to achieve that consensus, I would say.
Agreed. And it's positive to hear an optimistic voice in terms of the future of British politics there, Jonathan. So let's keep our fingers crossed that comes to being. I just want to wrap a couple of issues up. I mean, we know that millions of families up and down the country are really suffering at the moment in terms of cost of living, whether it's inflation or it's energy bills. And we know rightly that there is a great deal of focus on how we're keeping those bills manageable. And you mentioned the energy price cap earlier. So there's some good things going on, regardless of political colour that we're talking about. Then at conference, you were talking about the Great British Energy Company and creating a UK sovereign wealth fund. And I just sort of wonder, I'm trying to package those things up in terms of how would a Labour administration deal with the challenge of keeping bills as affordable as possible across our utilities, so whether it's broadband or electricity, gas or water, with the flip side that we need to invest tens and tens of billions right up and down the United Kingdom in terms of improving our resiliency and adaptation and pure net zero investments. Is that something that is achievable within the current confines of the bill? How would you set about that?
Yeah, that's a crucial question. I think fundamentally it is, but let me just sort of strip down some levels of that. I mean, first of all, I talked earlier in the podcast about catalytic public investment and what is necessary to bring in private investment. When we talk about the National Wealth Fund, that's all that is. That's the public money that we think needs to go into certain opportunities. And the National Wealth Fund is how the state would manage that. So, for instance, we talked about, let's give an example specifically. This country needs 10 battery gigafactories by 2040. We've got one. We've seen an issue this week that the second one, British Volt, might not go ahead. Every gigafactory in the world has required some level of public incentive, some level of public investment. That's how we would manage that. You know, that's just a practical thing. So again, important to stress, that's about leveraging in private investment, not about crowding it out. And GB Energy be a part of that division of that would specifically look at some of the energy investments that are required and hold those together. On the other things, I mean, look, I'd make some distinctions in certain areas. Okay. I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, for instance, if you asked the British public about their view on some of the water companies, they'd be very strident in that, you know, and I think it's important to recognise not all of those companies have operated in the same way, but I think there's a broad cross-party view now shared by the regulator that, you know, too much money has been allowed out of those corporate structures versus the balance between longer-term investments in the last few years. I think that the regulators themselves can clearly onto that case and can tighten up and do it. I think the British public are quite happy to understand about the need to invest in opportunities for the future, but they just want a fair deal, you know. And if that is, those corporate structures should be transparent and they should be able to demonstrate quite clearly to the public the balance they are undertaking between, you know, how much they're charging the public, what is going back into the system, what is going out in terms of dividends. And if, like any business, that that doesn't seem right and the public don't have consent on that, they're going to voice those concerns. And that's a reasonable part of it. But I think fundamentally, on your sort of macro question there, is it possible to simultaneously be cognizant of these real cost of living pressures people are under and provide still a regulatory framework that allows for investment for the future alongside that? Yes, I think it is. Nothing is ever easy when people are facing the kind of pressures they are under. But fundamentally, the reason people are under so much pressure in the UK, and there are some incredible headwinds, you know, in a geopolitical sense at the minute, is I would say, you know, people were not, unfortunately, resilient enough going into these crises. And there'll always be crises, but how resilient the country is going into those is the business of government. And I do think since 2010, we've seen a very significant rise in overall levels of poverty, food bank dependency, and so forth. And actually, it's no surprise then when you hit something like the energy crisis, people are in such a vulnerable position. And I think the, you know, the job of the government in fixing that is to care about the cost of living crisis. But part of the answer is making sure the long-term resilience of the country is improving. And that clearly requires investment to do it. And I think actually, you know, when I talk to a lot of people, obviously in my brief, I'm dealing with a lot of quite senior business people and investors in the country. What I'm struck by is that's exactly how they see it as well. You know, they want a country that gives their business opportunities, but, you know, they care about the impact of those investments. They want to see a prosperous, successful country and recognize that's part of the challenge as well. So look, I'm not saying these are easy, but I think it's possible to get that balance right.
I think the key phrase you use there is fairness, and actually trying to establish a fair return for investor and a fair bill for the consumer is the central facet to that. So I realise we're coming to the end of our time. So a couple of wrap-up questions. This one is a really simple one, Jonathan, so I'm sure you'll agree. In the last Labour manifesto, nationalisation was writ large, and we saw sort of Labour also outlining plans recently around nationalising rail over the autumn. From our infrastructure investors' point of view, can we assume that that's as far as nationalisation plans go now, and that the sort of the broader nationalisation plans in the last manifesto are no more?
Well, those former plans are no more. I mean, as I say, I'm quite open when I talk about how I think that the balance of, you know, those manifestos in terms of what they thought was possible from the state and what was desirable to do, I didn't think they had it right. And I think they fundamentally didn't appreciate that the need to have that partnership with business and to, you know, recognise an internationally competitive environment. And on nationalisation, for us, it's a pragmatic question. It's a pragmatic question of what will deliver the kind of outcomes that we want to see. And so specifically on rail, I mean, I think it's a relatively straightforward, vast amounts of the rail network are in public ownership already. I think broadly speaking, franchising has run its course. I mean, people will be familiar, my regular line is the West Coast between London and Manchester, and there aren't really the bidders to have a competitive market in place. And, you know, the service has been absolutely terrible now for a few months. There's no obvious person to come in and replace that. So frankly, I think the Conservative Party almost are in the same place on that. But no, the wider plans on, when we have something like the energy crisis, we come under significant pressure to say, well, to nationalise the whole system. But it's not the answer, you know. And I do, if there's one thing I could stress to your, you know, listeners and your members, it would be that we do understand that the investment challenge in the UK, which we're putting front and centre, you know, requires people to have confidence that they can invest for the long term in the UK. And I do think, as I say, rail's a different case because of the where it has got to over successive years. But it's not the approach of the last few Labour manifestos, and I'm quite candid in that.
That's very fair, and I think very reassuring, Jonathan. So thank you for that. Now, finally, I could make life very easy for you and say what you think the outcome of the next general election will be, but that will be far too easy for you, and I'm not going to let you off that lightly. So I'm going to ask you the most challenging question of the whole thing now. Knowing that you support a certain Sunderland FC, the question is, where are you going to be at the end of the season? You're sort of mid-table-ish at the moment, all quite tight, quite squeaky.
Well, first of all, I think there's ever been a bit of my life where both the Labour Party and Sunderland were doing well simultaneously, so I'm slightly nervous about that. I think, actually, we might make the playoffs if we do a bit of good business in the January transfer window. What I would say, I'm fascinated by, I love everything about football, and I'm from Sunderland, hence it's the only reason you tend to support Sunderland. But the business model Sunderland has got now, which is buying younger players, trying to develop them for the future, has not only produced a far better financial position for the club, the team is actually miles better because it's full of young, hungry players who want to prove themselves or who have a difficult, you know, transfer beforehand and now they come through. it, for me, it is a good example of the day-to-day and the long-term. Getting both right is not an opposite. So there's an economic investment lesson there, as well as a blind hope for the future that we might make the playoffs. It was certainly one of the best teams in the division, but for a newly promoted team from League One, we're doing pretty canny.
A great politician's answer, and I'm sure the Sunderland Football Club will be proud of you for that one. And I should say, for our American listeners, we are talking soccer, so yeah.
We are, but you see, one thing, Sunderland appeared on a Netflix documentary, and so I find now people all around the world have strong views on why, you know, for instance, Sunderland's Josh Madger in the transfer window 4 years ago, and that sort of thing. It is a good example of branding as well.
Oh, great stuff. Well, thank you so much this afternoon, Jonathan. I think that's been an absolutely great conversation. I think we could have carried on for a long, long time, but I think we've nailed some really good points in our discussion here, and really appreciate your time, because I know Parliament is very much in full swing at the moment with lots going on. So thank you so much, and it's been a great discussion.
No, really appreciate it. And just to say, I mean, you know, we are doing some really significant business engagement now for the Labour Party. It's something I've always wanted to be in charge of, and people are very kindly saying they really recognise the difference. So for any of your members and listeners, maybe they want to, you know, a bespoke conversation or follow up on any of these points, we're always happy to do that if they want to get in touch.
Great stuff. Thanks, Jonathan. Great note to finish on. And that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you for listening, and look out for our next episode coming soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Talking Global Infrastructure. For more information about GIIA, please visit our website, giia.net, and look out for the next edition of our podcast by following us on LinkedIn and Twitter.